Man has invented his doom. First step was touching the moon. There's a woman on my block, and she sits there in a cold chill. She says, who's gonna take away his license to kill?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Amnesty International's lead crisis researcher, Donatella Rivera, who leads the way in monitoring human rights crises in the world's hotspots. She goes where few are able or willing to venture. In the last year alone, she's led Amnesty's research missions in Libya, where she was under fire in Misrata, South Sudan's Nuba Mountains, and most recently Syria, where she spent weeks inside 23 villages following the path of the Syrian army and hearing from Syrian citizens about the atrocities their government committed along the way. One of very few journalists and human rights monitors have been on the ground in Syria in recent months. She is just back from having sneaked across the border into Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Donatella Rivera.
Thank you.
And congratulations for being alive, and and my salutations to your courage. This is not a normal job that you've taken on here.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it is where it's most necessary to monitor human rights abuses in situations of conflict. That also, it's a job that has some sort of operational problems, and sometimes we have to go to places where the players are not very happy for us to be there. So, yeah, we have to find ways to work around that.
And you're up against the need on the part of dictators and mass murderers to kill the messenger. I mean, that is the threat that you have.
Yes, I mean, that's obviously an extreme threat. I would stress, though, that really those who are most at risk in all the conflicts that I've worked in are the local populations. They are really the ones that are at the receiving end of the most, of the worst atrocities. So I think for people like myself, at the end of the day, I don't have to go, and I generally can leave when I want to leave. It's the plight of the local population that we must never forget.
And the ones that you leave behind, they have been telling you, apparently, why is the world not doing anything to help us?
Yes, that's really been perhaps the most persistent question that I've come across in all the towns and villages, the people I spoke to, because obviously they've been at the receiving end of the worst atrocities for 16 months now, and they don't see any light at the end of the tunnel. And they really are finding it very difficult to understand why the international community has been looking the other way for so long, and really not putting the pressure where it needs to be put to bring help and relief to the ordinary people of Syria. Much of the discussion has been, and understandably so, about diplomatic initiatives, and there need to be diplomatic initiatives, of course, about this or that military option, but really not a lot about what concretely can be done that would make a difference to ordinary men, women, and children up and down the country.
So what do you think it will take for something to be done? I mean, the fact that few people are allowed in and you have to sneak in and journalists, by and large, have to sneak in, we get little YouTube videos, but we only get sort of little windows of what's going on here. And I think the full horror is not told, even though you have been managed to provide us with some of the information and facts. And why don't you, well, firstly, if you could give me your ideas of why it is that the world has seemed so paralyzed.
Perhaps on the one hand, there was a failure to understand earlier on that this was that the scale of, you know, to understand the scale of the problem, and so there was such a failure on the part of the international community to deal with this in a timely manner. Because really, if enough had been done to put pressure on the Syrian regime last year, when the situation was much less complex, and therefore there were more sort of realistically possible options to address it, we would not perhaps have got to the stage where we're today, where there is so much hatred, where so much has happened, and the situation is now much more difficult and, you know, much more difficult to resolve. Why has there been such a paralysis? Obviously, you know, much is talked about the differences between Europe and North America on the one hand, and Russia and China and Iran and others on the other hand, on the side of the Syrian regime. That is true, and certainly, especially a country like Russia has been playing a very unhelpful role at the international level. However, even countries that are talking tough today, including the United States, didn't really pull their weight as much as they should have much earlier on. Of course, now we've got to a very, very difficult stage where... you know, there are a variety of options. None of them are particularly good.
Again, I'm speaking with Amnesty International's lead crisis researcher, Donatella Rivera, who is just back from Syria, where she sneaked across the border to witness human rights atrocities in 23 villages following the path of the Syrian army. And the reports that you have, I read a piece by you in Al Jazeera, and I think you had a piece in The Guardian as well, describing what you had seen. One of the things that I spoke recently with a Syrian documentary filmmaker who was trying to document some of these atrocities, and his colleague was killed, and he managed to escape. He said that, you know, we hear the figure of, what, about 15,000 dead or whatever the so-called official figure is. But he pointed out that there's up to 100,000 people that have been detained, 50,000 missing. And some of the descriptions that you've given from, well, that were given to you when you debriefed people who had been imprisoned are absolutely shocking and makes you begin to wonder whether they're lowballed, in other words, that maybe there's 100,000 people have been killed.
We just don't know, the truth is. As often, you know, it's said that in war, truth is one of the first casualties. And I think this is very true in the case of Syria. We get little videos that are being uploaded to YouTube every day by activists. We hear, you know, bits of information here and there. It's only when it's possible to go in. And I mean, you know, I went to 23 towns and villages. One would need to spend months. And then even that, you know, you can't go everywhere just because of the fighting. So we don't know how many people really are dead and how many people are missing. I mean, what I can tell you is that the people I've spoken to who had been lucky enough to be released and who had horrendous scars of torture, open wound, and who spoke about those who remained in detention and those who died in custody, it is absolutely horrific. And I've spoken to people who have been detained before and who say without a shadow of doubt, I would rather die than go through that again. I would prefer to be killed than to be again arrested and detained and tortured as I was. So that, you know, that's how bad things are. Another problem, of course, is, you know, when one does not control the sources of information, you know, some of the information that is being put out on YouTube video and so on by all party is manipulated. So we have to be very, very careful. And that's why it's so important to try and go and find out and investigate firsthand.
Which is what you've done, and you've lived to tell the tale. And in the case of Ahmad, this is what you have written about debriefing him. We were taken into the military security headquarters in Idlib city and were put in a room measuring about 5 by 4 meters with about 120 other detainees. It was so crowded we could not move. We were tortured during interrogation sessions lasting 2 to 4 hours. Ahmed was one of the first to be interrogated on the second day. He was in a terrible state and could hardly move. And when he came back, he was again taken to interrogation on the fourth day. He must have died because he never came back to the cell. Now, that's the testimony of, not of Ahmed, but of...
of another young man who was detained with him. Right. Yes, in a village where virtually, it's a tiny little village in the Jabal al-Wastani area in the Idlib province, where half of the youth of the village were killed in one particular day, and others were detained, and... some of those were detained or missing. I mean, I have, I absolutely realize that the people I've been able to speak to, those were the lucky ones who managed to get out, either because they were of no interest to the security forces that had them, or because somebody paid a lot of money to get them out, which of course is happening too. People pay money to be released, and in some cases that's working. I mean, just 2 weeks ago, three young medics that I had met in Aleppo. Aleppo is Syria's biggest city, the wealthiest city, the sort of economic capital of Syria, where there has been no armed conflict. It's just been peaceful demonstrations, and I watched every day as security forces were shooting live rounds and killing and injuring demonstrators every single day that I was there. Aleppo is a microcosm of what the rest of Syria was like a year ago. There was no armed conflict. It was just peaceful demonstrations and the security forces firing. These three young men who were helping to basically providing life-saving medical treatment for injured protesters who cannot go to hospitals because if they do, they will be arrested and tortured and possibly killed. Well, three of these young medics were themselves arrested at the end of June. And after a week, their bodies were found with torture marks, including missing nails that had their nails taken off, broken teeth, gunshot in the head. So they were obviously then killed by gunshot. And then their bodies were set on fire. They were burned and they were dumped on the outskirts of the town with their IDs put next to the bodies after the bodies were burned to make sure that, you know, people knew who they were as a warning to others. So this is the kind of atrocities that the regime has continued to commit against people who certainly present no threat. I mean, they're not involved in any armed activities.
But this is the modus operandi of the Assad family since the 1980s with the Hama massacre, where they basically, their compact with the Syrian people is that don't ever threaten us or challenge us, otherwise we'll kill you. But these are the rules and you follow them and everybody be fine. And the minute that people got fed up, and it actually started in the working class poor neighborhood in Deraa on the Jordanian border, and now, of course, it's escalated. You mentioned the possibility of criminality there in terms of paying off the regime. I understand the regime uses the same methodology as Milosevic used in emptying prisons and stuff and using thugs in the case of the Shabiha, which quite often are prison guards and thugs, etc., who are paid to do these atrocities. Is there an analogy there with Milosevic and his killing machine?
I don't like to compare because obviously, you know, each case, to itself. I mean, certainly, there is a long history of very brutal repression and including crimes against humanity committed by the Syrian regime. Obviously, the case that you mentioned, the massacre of so many people back in the early 80s, that was under the leadership of the current president's father.
And it was perpetrated by the former president's brother, who has been living in luxury and exile in London. And apparently these massacres are being conducted by the current president's brother, Maha. So there's a kind of historical analogy there, isn't there?
There certainly is being a continuity in the Syrian regime and the continuity in terms of, you know, the kinship of the people who are at the helm of this regime, as well as in continuity in terms of the method. Obviously, we are now in a new century, you know, in the era of mobile phones and internet and so on. So, you know, the kind of large-scale massacres that were committed in the early 80s, it's become much more difficult to do that sort of thing and keep it quite secret in a way that happened then. This couldn't be done now. But certainly we've seen terrible repression by the Syrian regime. So what's been happening since the beginning of the uprising, which, you know, we shouldn't forget the first victims were children because of some graffiti, anti-government graffiti that was scrawled on the walls of a children's school. The children who might not even have been the authors of these graffiti were detained and tortured. You know, that's how it all started in Deraa 16 months ago, and you know, so much else since then. So it's really not surprising. What is surprising, perhaps, is that the regime may not have understood that, especially after what happened in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Libya, that there is a new generation of much more fearless people, just young people who also have not lived through the blind repression of the 80s that their parents know so well, and who are ready to keep going and demonstrating every day until today, knowing that they may be killed. So it's not going to be easy to silence, even with the kind of repression that we've seen going on for so long.
Again, I'm speaking with Amnesty International's lead crisis researcher, Donatella Rivera, who is just back from Syria, where she snuck across the border to document human rights abuses, war crimes, and atrocities against innocent civilians working inside of 23 villages following the path of the Syrian army, and hearing from Syrian citizens who have lost their loved ones. The descriptions that the people give of how the army comes in and rounds up the young men, but totally indiscriminate. They'll kill children. Some of the descriptions of the killing of children are really hard to take, and it leads you to, I mean, I imagine since you've witnessed so much mayhem around the world, have you ever figured it out how people can cross that line into that kind of bestiality and feel justified?
As you say, unfortunately, in the job that I do, I've seen this time and time again in so many different countries. When we're seeing sort of repression on this scale, it often is accompanied by varying levels of absolute gratuitous brutality. For example, some of the cases, there was a case in Sermin where the security forces, the army, took out three young men from their home in front of their mother, killed them outside, and then set the bodies on fire. And this was in the morning, and did not allow their mother and sister, who were in the house and who saw this happening, to then go and get the bodies until the evening. So not all, you know, in addition to the crime that they had committed, there was this kind of absolutely, you know, gratuitous violence of burning the bodies. And this has happened in other places, in Taftanaz, you know, an 80-year-old man, his body was burned, as if they do so to terrorize and intimidate the community into submission. That may be one explanation. They want to be feared. It's difficult to understand the mechanism that leads people to commit such atrocities. But certainly in Syria, it has happened in so many places. Also, what's important to note is that I found the same kind of brutal methods pretty much everywhere I've been. So quite clearly, this is not the action of a few rotten apples, so to speak, a few undisciplined members of the armed forces were taking sort of personal initiatives, because it's so widespread. It is being done by different units in different places at different times. This quite clearly points to a state policy, really, decided at the highest level.
Well, in the village of al-Bashiriya, where you took testimony, I just read from your testimony, the children were grazing the sheep on the hill when we saw the army come towards the village. My nephew ran up to get the children and bring them home. The soldiers caught up with them. They made them kneel and shot them dead. Little Juma, 8 years old, was shot in the throat and in the palms of both hands. His hands were raised. How could an 8-year-old boy be a threat to the Assad family? Apparently,
again,
they are.
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, this is another case where quite clearly there seemed to have been a willingness, a desire to intimidate the community. The nephew who had gone up to try and get the children home was himself an armed opponent, with the Free Syrian Army, but he wasn't armed at the time, and he just went up to get his cousins. Mm-hmm. Not satisfied with having got him, they went after the children as well who were with him. you know, that seems to be sort of part of this pattern of wanting to intimidate and make everybody fear so much that they will have nothing to do with the opposition. Until now, it hasn't worked. It has actually quite clearly brought about the opposite result.
Well, just in closing, Donatella Rivera, what would you ask of our audience who are probably quite disturbed by what they've heard and probably feel quite helpless to do anything, even though they might well feel the impulse that something should be done?
Very important to let our governments know that all options have to be considered to bring help and relief to the civilian population in Syria, not just military option. For example, at the moment there is discussions about renewing the mandate of the current UN mission in Syria. The mission is there with the wrong mandate. It was there to observe a ceasefire, which never came about. It's vitally important that there is a UN mission with an expanded mandate, with a mandate and the necessary resources to monitor and investigate war crimes and crimes against humanity, so that we can, on the one hand, send a very clear message to the Syrian leadership that the time for impunity is over, and that there can be the basis laid for accountability and justice for those who are victims of human rights abuses.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Donatella Rivera.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Donatella Rivera, who's Amnesty International's lead crisis researcher. She leads the way in monitoring human rights crises in the world's hotspots and goes where few are able or willing to venture. In the last year alone, she led Amnesty's research missions in Libya, where she was under fire in Misrata, South Sudan's Nuba Mountains, and most recently Syria, where she spent weeks inside 23 villages following the path of the Syrian army and hearing from Syrian citizens about the atrocities their government committed along the way. One of very few journalists or human rights monitors who have been on the ground in Syria in recent months. She's just back from having sneaked across the border into Syria. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Brooke Peterson. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.